hands are another one. You should know by now that there's always another copy. Risa won't take it.
How dare you make me say this?
Your histrionics are uncalled for. There's absolutely nothing in there that isn't true.
It doesn't matter. It's not the words, it's what's implied.
Roberta shrugs.
Truth is truth. Implications are subjective. People will hear your words and draw their own conclusions.
Don't try to double-think me, Roberta. I'm not as stupid or naive as you'd like to think.
Then the expression on Roberta's face changes. She becomes coolly direct, no more posturing.
This is what is required of you, so this is what you will do. Or perhaps you've forgotten our arrangement.
It's a threat as thinly veiled as the sheerest silk. Then, out of nowhere, they hear,
"What arrangement?"
They both turn to see Cam coming out into the garden. Roberta throws Risa a warning glance, and Risa looks down to the crumpled piece of paper at her feet, saying nothing.
"Her spine, of course," Roberta says. "In return for very expensive and state-of-the-art spinal replacement surgery, Risa has agreed to become a part of the proactive citizenry family, and every member of the family has a role to play."
Then she holds out the paragraph to Risa again. Risa knows she has no choice but to take it. She looks to the video crew, who wait impatiently to do their job, then back to Roberta.
"Do you want me to stand beside the wheelchair?"
Risa asks.
"No, you should sit in it," Roberta tells her. "Then rise halfway through. That will be more effective, don't you think?"
Public service announcement.
"I was paralyzed. A victim of the clapper attack at Happy Jack Harvest Camp. I used to hate the very idea of unwinding. Then overnight, I was the one with a desperate medical need. Without unwinding, I would have been denied a new spine. Without unwinding, I would be confined to this wheelchair for the rest of my life. I was a state ward. I was an AWOL. I was a paraplegic. But now I'm none of those things. My name is Risa Ward, and unwinding changed my life."
Paid for by the National Whole Health Society. Risa has always thought of herself as a survivor. She managed the treacherous waters of Ohio State Home 23 until the day she became a budget cut and was pruned for unwinding. Then she survived as an AWOL, then at Harvest Camp, and then even survived a devastating explosion that should have killed her. Her strength has always been her keen mind and her ability to adapt. Well, adapt to this. A life of minor celebrity, all the comforts you could desire, a smart and charming boy infatuated with you, and the abandonment of everything you believe, along with the abdication of your conscience. Risa sits on a plush lawn chair in the backyard of the Cliffside Estate, looking out at the tropical sunset, pondering these things and trying to infuse perspective and peace back into her mind. There's a powerful surge against her soul, as relentless as the waves crashing below, reminding her that in time the strongest of mountains is eroded into the sea, and she doesn't know how much longer she can resist it, or even if she should. There was a news interview this morning. She tried to answer questions in a way so that she never actually had to lie. It's true that her support of unwinding is a matter of necessity, but no one but she and Roberta know what has made it so necessary. No matter how hard she tries, though, things come out of her mouth that she can't believe she said. Unwinding is the least of all evils.
Is there actually a part of her that believes that?
The constant manipulation has left her internal compass spinning so wildly, she's afraid she'll never find true north again. Exhausted, she dozes, and it seems only seconds later she's awakened by someone gently shaking her shoulder. It's night now. Just the slightest trace of blue on the horizon holds the memory of dusk.
"Sawing wood," Cam says. "I didn't know you snored."
"I don't,"
she says groggily.
"I'm sticking to my story."
Cam has a blanket with him.
It's only as he wraps it around her that she realizes how chilled she has gotten while she slept. Even in this tropical environment, the air can get cool at night.
"I wish you wouldn't spend so much time alone," he says. "You don't have to, you know."
"When you've spent most of your life in a state home, solitude feels like a luxury."
He kneels beside her.
"We have our first interview together next week. They're flying us to the mainland. Has Roberta told you?"
Risa sighs.
"I know all about it."
"We're supposed to be a couple."
"So I'll smile and do my job for the camera. You don't have to worry."
"I was hoping you wouldn't see it as a job."
Rather than looking at him, she looks up to see a sky full of stars, even fuller than the sky over the graveyard. But there, she rarely had the time or the inclination to look heavenward.
"I know all their names," Cam offers. "The stars, that is."
"Don't be ridiculous. There are billions of stars. You can't know them all."
"Hyperbole," he says. "I guess I'm exaggerating. But I do know all the ones that matter."
Then he begins pointing them out, his voice taking on just the slightest Boston accent as he accesses the living star chart in his head.
"That's Alpha Centauri, which means foot of the centaur. It's one of the closest stars to us. That bright one to the right, that's Sirius, the brightest star in the sky."
His voice begins to feel hypnotic to her, and it brings her a hint of the peace she's been craving.
"Am I making this more difficult than it has to be?" Risa wonders. "Should I find a way to adapt?"
"That dim one is Spica, which is actually 100 times brighter than Sirius, but it's much farther away."
Risa has to remind herself that her choice to get with Proactive Citizenry's program was not out of selfishness. So shouldn't her conscience be appeased? And if not, if her conscience is the only thing dragging her to dark depths, shouldn't she be able to cut it loose in order to survive?
"That's Andromeda, which is actually a whole galaxy."
There is a sense of arrogance to Cam's bragging, but also an innocence to it, like a little kid wanting to show off what he learned in school that day. But he never learned any of this, did he? The accent with which he now speaks makes it clear that the information was someone else's that got shoved into his head.
"Stop it, Risa,"
she tells herself. Perhaps it's time to let the mountain erode. And so despite the part of herself that would resist, she gets out of her chair and lies on the grass beside him, looking up at the spray of stars.
"Polaris is always easy to find. It's directly over the North Pole. So if you know where it is, you can always find true north."
Hearing him say that makes her gasp. He turns to look at her.
"Aren't you going to shut me up?"
Risa laughs at that.
"I was hoping you'd put me back to sleep."
"Oh, am I that boring?"
"Only slightly."
Then he reaches over and gently brushes her arm. Risa pulls away and sits up.
"Don't. You know I don't like to be touched."
"Is it that you don't like to be touched, or that you don't like to be touched by me?"
She doesn't answer him.
"What's that one?"
she asks, pointing.
"The red one."
"Betelgeuse,"
he tells her. Then, after an awkward silence, he says,
"What was he like?"
"Who?"
"You know."
Risa sighs.
"It's not a place you want to go, Cam."
"Maybe I do."
She doesn't have the strength to fight it. So she lies back down and fixes her eyes on the stars as she speaks.
"Impulsive, brooding, occasionally self-loathing."
"Sounds like a real gem."
"You didn't let me finish. He's also clever, loyal, passionate, responsible, and a strong leader, but is too humble to admit all that to himself."
"Is?"
"Was,"
she says, covering.
"Sometimes it feels like he's still here."
"I think I would have liked to have known him."
Risa shakes her head.
"He'd hate you."
"Why?"
"Because he was also jealous."
Silence falls between them again, but this time it's not awkward at all.
"I'm glad he shared that with me,"
Cam says.
"There's something I'd like to share with you, too."
Risa has no idea what he's going to say, but she finds she's actually curious.
"Did you know a kid named Samson when you were back at the state home?"
he asks. She searches her thoughts.
"Yes, he was on the harvest camp bus with me."
"Well, he had a secret crush on you."
At first it boggles Risa how he would know this, and when the truth dawns on her, a surge of reflexive adrenaline triggers her fight-or-flight response. She gets up, fully prepared to run back to the mansion, or jump off the cliff, or whatever it will take to get away from this revelation, but Cam eclipses her like a moon before one of his precious stars.
"Algebra," he says. "He was a math whiz. I got the part of him that does algebra. It's just a tiny part, but when I came across your picture, well, I guess it was enough to make me stop and take notice. Then, when Roberta heard that you'd been captured, she pulled strings to get you here, for me. So, it's my fault that you're here."
She doesn't want to look at him, but she can't stop. It's like looking at a traffic accident.
"How am I supposed to feel about this, Cam? I can't pretend not to be horrified. I'm here because of some whim you had, but that whim wasn't even yours. It was that poor kid's."
"No, it wasn't like that," says Cam quickly. "Samson was like a friend who taps you on the shoulder to get your attention. But what I feel for you, it's all me. Not just algebra, but, well, the whole equation."
She turns her back to him, grabbing the blanket and wrapping it around herself.
"I want you to go now."
"I'm sorry," he says, "but I didn't want there to be any secrets between us."
"Please, leave."
He keeps his distance, but he doesn't go.
"I'd rather be partly great than entirely useless. Wasn't that the last thing he said to you? I feel it's my responsibility to make that wish come true."
And finally, he goes inside, leaving her alone with way too many people's thoughts. 10 minutes later, Risa still stands with the blanket wrapped around her, not wanting to go inside, but the circular pattern of her own thoughts begins to nauseate her.
"I can't give in to this. I must give in to this. I can't give in to this."
Over and over, until she just wants to shut herself down. When she finally steps into the house, she hears music. Which is not unusual, but this music isn't being pumped through the sound system. Someone is playing classical guitar. The piece sounds Spanish, and although many things sound Spanish when played on a classical 12-string, this has a definite flamenco feel. Risa follows the tune to the main living room, where Cam sits, curled over the instrument, lost in the music he's playing. She didn't even know he played. But she shouldn't be surprised. He came loaded with a veritable full house of skills. Still, playing guitar like this requires the melding of many things. Muscle memory, combined with cortical and auditory memory. Everything linked through a brainstem capable of coordinating it all. The music lulls her, disarms her, enchants her. And she begins to realize that these are not just other people's parts. Someone is pulling those parts together. For the first time, Risa truly begins to see Cam as an individual, struggling to pull together the many gifts he's been given. He didn't ask for these things, and he couldn't refuse them if he wanted to. As horrified as she was by him 5 minutes ago, this new revelation soothes her. It compels her to sit at the piano across the room and begin a simple accompaniment. When he hears her, he brings his instrument closer and sits beside her. No words are spoken. Instead, they communicate through the rhythms and harmonies. He lets her take control of the piece, lets it evolve at her hand. Then she seamlessly gives it over to him again. They could go on for hours, and soon realize that they actually have, but neither one wants to be the first to stop. Maybe, Risa thinks, there is a way to make this life work, and maybe there's not. But right now, in the moment, there's nothing more wonderful than losing herself to the music. Until now, she had forgotten how good that feels. 47. Audience. Back from commercial, the studio audience applauds on cue, as if the viewers at home missed something.
For those of you just tuning in, says one of the show's hosts, our guests today are Camu Kumpri and Risa Ward.
The young man with multiple skin tones that are exotic yet pleasing to the eye waves to the audience with one hand. With the other, he clasps the hand of the pretty girl next to him. The couple looks perfect, as if they were meant to be. Camu, the audience quickly learns, prefers to be called Cam. He's even more interesting to behold in person than in the many teaser ads they've seen, ads that prepared them for something mysterious and wonderful. But this boy isn't mysterious at all, just wonderful, and they are certainly not shocked by his appearance, because the ads have fermented shock into intoxicating curiosity. The studio audience, as well as the audience at home, is more than primed, because they know this is something special. This is Cam's first major public appearance, and what better way to welcome him into the spotlight than on Brunch with Jarvis and Holly, a friendly, non-threatening morning talk show. Everyone loves Jarvis and Holly, who are so funny together and are in such comfortable command of their fashionably decorated faux living room set.
Cam, there's quite a controversy as to how you came to be. I wonder how you feel about that,
asks Holly.
Not my problem, Cam says. It used to bother me when people would say terrible things about me, but I came to realize it only matters what one person thinks.
Yourself,
Holly prompts.
No, her,
he says and glances at Risa. The audience laughs. Risa offers a humble smile. Then Holly and Jarvis go into some cute little banter about who wears the pants in various relationships. Jarvis poses the next question.
Risa, you've been through a lot yourself. A ward of the state, a rehabilitated AWOL. I'm sure our audience would love to know how you and Cam met.
I got to know Cam after my spinal surgery, Risa tells the world. It was the same clinic where he got put together. He came to see me every day to talk to me. Eventually, I came to realize that...
She hesitates for a moment, perhaps choked up by her emotions.
I came to realize that his whole was greater than the sum of his parts.
It is just the type of thing people love to hear. The whole audience releases a collective,
"Aww."
Cam smiles at Risa and clasps her hand tighter.
We've all seen your public service announcements, says Holly. I still get chills when I see you rise out of that wheelchair.
Then she turns to the audience.
Am I right?
The audience applauds in agreement. Then she turns back to Risa.
Yet I would think when you were an AWOL, you must have been very much against unwinding.
Well, says Risa, who wouldn't be against it when you're the one being unwound?
So, exactly when did your feelings change?
Risa takes a visibly deep breath, and Cam squeezes her hand again.
It isn't so much that they changed, but I found myself having to accept a broader perspective. If it hadn't been for unwinding, Cam wouldn't exist, and we wouldn't be here together today. There's always going to be suffering in the world, but unwinding takes suffering away from those of us...
She hesitates again.
Those of us living meaningful lives.
So then, Jarvis asks. What would you say to kids out there who are AWOL?
Risa looks down rather than at Jarvis when she speaks.
I would say if you're running, then run, because you have every right to try to survive. But no matter what happens to you, know that your life has meaning.
Maybe even more meaning if they're unwound? Prompts Jarvis.
Maybe so.
Then they segue into an introduction of a top fashion designer, here to present a whole new line of trend-setting patchwork clothes inspired by Camu Kumpri. Designs for men and women, boys and girls.
We call it Rewind Chic,
says the designer, and models parade out to gleeful applause. 48. Risa. Once their appearance with Jarvis and Holly is over, Risa holds Cam's hand until they are backstage and out of view of the audience. Then she releases it in disgust. Not disgust at him, but at herself.
What is it?
Cam asks.
I'm sorry if I did something wrong.
Shut up, just shut up!
She looks for the bathroom but can't find it. This blasted studio set is a maze, and everyone from the interns to the crew stares at them as they pass, as if they're royalty. These people must get celebrities on this show every day, so what makes them any different? But she knows the answer to that. After a while, a celebrity is just a celebrity, but there is only one Camus Compris. He is the new golden child of humanity. And, as for Risa, well, it's guilt, G-I-L-T, by association. Finally, she finds the bathroom and locks herself in, sits on the toilet, and buries her head in her hands. To have to defend unwinding, to have to say that the world is a better place because innocent kids are being unwound, shreds her inside. Her self-respect, her integrity are gone. Now, not only does she wish she hadn't survived the explosion at Happy Jack, she wishes she had never been born at all.
Why are you doing this, Risa?
It's the voices of all the kids at the graveyard.
Why?
It's the voice of Connor, accusing her, and rightfully so. She wishes she could explain her reasons to him, and the deal with the devil she made with Roberta. A she-devil with the power to build herself a perfect boy. And perfect he very well may be, at least by society's definition. Risa can't deny that with each day Cam grows more and more into his potential. He's smart and strong, and has the capacity to be profoundly wise when he's not being profoundly self-centered. The fact that she's starting to see him as a real boy, and not a piecemeal Pinocchio, bothers her almost as much as the things she said today on camera. There is an urgent banging at the bathroom door.
Risa!
Cam calls.
Are you okay? Please, come out, you're scaring me!
Leave me alone!
Risa shouts. He says nothing more, but when she finally leaves the bathroom 5 minutes later, he's still standing there, waiting. He would probably have waited all day and all night. She wonders whether such unyielding resolve came from his parts, or if it's something he's developed on his own. She suddenly finds herself bursting into tears and throwing herself into his arms, not even knowing why. She wants to tear him to bits, yet she desperately wants him to comfort her. She wants to destroy everything he represents, and yet she wants to cry on his shoulder because she has no other shoulder to cry on. Around them, people ogle them, trying to be inconspicuous about it. Their hearts are warmed by what appears to be the embrace of two souls in love.
Unfair,
he says.
They shouldn't make you do these things if you're not ready to do them.
And the fact that he, the subject of all this attention, understands her, empathizes with her, and is somehow on her side, confuses everything inside her even more.
It's not always going to be like this,
Cam whispers to her. She wants to believe that, but right now she can only imagine it being worse. 49. Cam. There are things that Roberta hasn't told him. Her control over Risa is more than a mere matter of wills. It's not as simple as gratitude for a new spine, because Risa isn't grateful at all. It's very clear that her spine is a burden she wishes she didn't have to bear. Then why did she consent? Every moment they're together, the question hangs heavy in the air. But when he broaches the subject, all Risa says is,
"It was something I had to do."
And when he tries to probe deeper, she loses patience and tells him to stop pushing.
My reasons are my own.
He wants to believe that he's the reason why she's doing all the things she's doing, all these things that clearly go against her grain. But if there are any parts of him that are naive enough to believe that she'd do these interviews and ads for his sake, they are outnumbered by the parts of him that know better. Their appearance on Brunch with Jarvis and Holly made it painfully clear that whatever pain Risa is feeling over her part in all this runs very deep. The fact that she allowed him to comfort her didn't change that. If anything, it made him feel a responsibility to get to the bottom of it, not just for his own sake, but for hers. For how could anything between them ever be real without a full disclosure? It all comes down to the day she signed that consent form. But asking Roberta about it is a useless endeavor. Then Cam realizes he doesn't have to, because Roberta is the queen of surveillance videos.
I need to see the surveillance records from April 17th.
Cam tells the security guard he's most friendly with, the one he plays basketball with, after they return to Molokai.
No can do, he tells Cam right off the bat. No one sees those without permission from you-know-who. Get her permission, and I'll show you whatever you want.
She'll never know.
Don't matter.
But it'll matter if I tell her I caught you trying to steal from the mansion.
That makes the guard stutter.
Allow me, Cam says. You say, you son of a bitch, you can't do that. And I say, yes, I can. And who do you think she'll believe, me or you?
Then Cam hands him a flash drive.
So just put the files on this, and everyone's life will be easier.
The guard looks at him incredulously.
You're a real piece of work, you know that? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
And although Cam knows who he's referring to, he says,
I've got lots of trees. You'll have to be more specific.
That evening, the drive turns up in his desk drawer, packed with video files. He doubts he'll have a basketball partner anymore, but it's a small sacrifice to make. When it's late enough to know he won't be interrupted, he loads the files onto his personal viewer and witnesses something he was never supposed to see. 50. Risa. April 17th, almost 2 months ago, before the interviews and the public service announcements, before the operation that replaced Risa's severed spine. Risa sits in her wheelchair in a sparse cell with nothing to occupy her time but her own thoughts. A consent form folded into a paper airplane lies on the floor beneath a one-way mirror. She spends her time thinking about her friends, of Connor mostly. She wonders how he'll fare without her. Better, she hopes. If she could only get word to him that she's alive, that she hasn't been tortured at the hands of the juvies, and that she's not even in their hands, but in the hands of some other organization. Roberta comes in, as she did the day before, with a new consent form. She sits down at the table and slides the consent form and a pen toward Risa again. She smiles at Risa, but it's the smile of a snake about to coil around its prey.
Are you ready to sign? She asks.
Are you ready to see me fly another paper airplane?
Risa responds.
Airplanes, says Roberta brightly. Yes, why don't we talk about airplanes? Particularly the ones in the aircraft salvage yard. The place you call the graveyard? Let's talk about your many friends there.
At last, thinks Risa. She's going to question me.
Ask whatever you want, she says. But if I were you, I wouldn't trust a thing I say. No need to ask you questions, dear, Roberta says. We know all we need to know about the graveyard. You see, we allow your little AWOL sanctuary to exist because it serves our needs. Your needs? You're telling me you control the juvenile authority? Let's just say we have substantial sway. The juvenile authority has wanted to raid the graveyard for quite a while, but we're the ones holding them back. However, if I give the word, the graveyard will be cleaned out, and all those children who you fought so valiantly to save will be transported to harvest camps and unwound.
Risa can sense the rug being pulled out from under her.
You're bluffing. Am I? I believe you know our inside man. His name is Trace Neuhauser.
The news completely blindsides her.
Trace? He's provided us with all the information we need to make a takedown of the airplane graveyard quick and painless, hm?
She pushes the consent form just an inch closer to Risa.
However, it never needs to happen. None of those AWOLs need be unwound. Please, Risa, accept a new spine and do all we ask of you. If you do, I will personally guarantee that all 719 of your friends will be unharmed. Help me, Risa, and you'll save them.
Risa looks at the paper, seeing it in a terrible new light.
What types of things?
She asks.
What types of things will you ask me to do?
It will begin with Cam. You will put aside your feelings, whatever they may be, and learn to be kind to him. As for what other things we may ask of you, you will know when it is your time to know.
She waits for Risa's response, but she has none. The shrapnel of this bombshell has yet to come to rest. Risa's silence seems to satisfy Roberta, so she stands, leaving Risa with the form and the pen.
As you pointed out before, I won't take away your choice. It remains in your rights to refuse. But if you do, I hope you can live with the consequences.
Risa holds the pen in her hand and reads the document for the fourth time. A single page filled with incomprehensible legalese. She doesn't need to decipher the fine print. It's pretty obvious what it says. By signing it, she gives her express permission to replace her damaged spine with a healthy one, harvested from an anonymous unwind. How many times has she imagined what it would be like to walk again? How many times has she relived that moment at Happy Jack Harvest Camp, when the roof collapsed and crushed her back, and wondered what it would be like to have that moment erased? The way Risa saw it, however, the cost of the new spine would be her soul. Her conscience couldn't allow it. Not then, not ever, or so she thought. If she looks at the big picture and refuses to sign it, she makes a personal statement against a world that's lost its way. But no one will ever know, and her statement will cause hundreds of her friends to be unwound. Roberta claims that Risa has a choice, but what choice does she really have? She holds the pen firm, takes a deep breath, and signs her name.
51. Cam.
Roberta is overjoyed by the response to the Jarvis and Holly appearance. She's already fielded dozens of interview requests.
"We can afford to be choosy,"
she tells Cam the morning after he views the surveillance video.
"Quality versus quantity."
Cam says nothing, and Roberta is so wrapped up in her own plans she fails to notice that Cam isn't himself.
"You will put aside your feelings, whatever they may be, and learn to be kind to him."
He takes his frustration out alone on the basketball court, and when that doesn't calm him down, he takes it to the source. He searches the sprawling manor for Risa. He finds her in the kitchen, making herself a late-morning sandwich.
"I get tired of being served all the time," she says casually. "Sometimes all I want is a PB&J that I make myself."
She holds out the sandwich to him.
"You want this one? I'll make another."
When he doesn't take it, she looks at his eyes and sees how off he is.
"What's the matter? Have a fight with Mommy?"
"I know why you're here," he tells her. "I know all about your deal with Roberta and your friends at the graveyard."
She hesitates for a moment, then begins to eat her sandwich.
"You have your deal with her? I have mine,"
she says in a peanut butter muffled voice. She tries to walk away, but Cam grabs her. She quickly pulls out of his grasp and pushes him against the wall.
"I've come to accept it," she yells at him. "So you might as well too."
"So was it all just pretend? Is being nice to the freak just a performance to save your friends?"
"Yes,"
snaps Risa.
"At first."
"Now?
Do you really think so little of yourself? Do you really think I'm that good of an actress?"
"Then prove it,"
he demands.
"Prove that you feel anything but contempt for me."
"Right now, that's all I feel for you."
Then she storms out, hurling her sandwich into the trash. 5 minutes later, Cam swipes a pass card from an inattentive guard and uses it to get past the security door into the garage. Then he steals a motorcycle and takes off down the winding path out of the estate. He has no destination, just a burning need for acceleration. He's sure there is at least one speed freak in his head, maybe more. He knows several of his constituents drove motorcycles. He takes every turn too fast until he finally gets to the town of Kuala Pu'u, giving satisfaction to every self-destructive impulse that resides within him. Then he takes a turn too sharply, loses control, and flies from the bike, rolling over and over on the pavement. He's hurt, but he's alive.
Motorists stop and get out of their cars to help him, but he doesn't want their help. He gets to his feet and feels a sharp pain in his knee. His back feels shredded. Blood from beneath his hairline clouds his eyes.
"Hey, buddy, you okay?"
yells some tourist. Then he stops short.
"Hey! Hey, it's you! You're that Rewind kid! Hey, look, it's that Rewind kid!"
He hurries away from them and gets on the motorcycle again, riding back the way he came. By the time he arrives, there are already police cars out front. Roberta sees him and runs to him.
"Cam!"
she wails.
"What did you do? What did you do? My God! You need medical attention! We'll get the doctor right away!"
Then she turns angrily to the house guards.
"How could you let this happen?"
"It's not their fault," yells Cam. "I'm not a dog that got off its leash, so don't treat me like one."
"Let me look at your wounds."
"Back off!"
He yells loudly enough for her to actually back off. Then he pushes past everyone, goes up to his room, and locks the world out. A few minutes later, there's a gentle knocking at his door, as he knew there would be. Roberta, trying to handle her volatile boy with kid gloves. But it's not Roberta.
"Open up, Cam. It's Risa."
She's the second-to-last person he wants to see right now, but the fact that she came surprises him. The least he can do is open the door. She stands at his threshold with a first aid kit in her hand.
"It's really stupid to bleed out just because you're pissed off."
"I'm not bleeding out."
"But you are bleeding. Can I at least take care of the worst of it? Believe it or not, I was the chief medic at the graveyard. I dealt with stuff like this all the time."
He opens the door wider and lets her in. He sits at his desk chair and allows her to clean the wound on his cheek. Then she has him take off his torn shirt and begins cleaning his back. It stings, but he bears it without wincing.
"You're lucky," she tells him. "You have lacerations, but none of them need stitches, and you didn't tear any of your seams."
"I'm sure Roberta will be relieved."
"Roberta can go to hell."
For once, Cam agrees with her. She takes a look at his knee and tells him that whether he likes it or not, he's going to need to have it x-rayed. When she's done assessing his wounds, he takes a good look at her. If she's still angry at him from before, it doesn't show.
"I'm sorry," he says. "Going out like that was stupid."
"It was human,"
she points out. Cam reaches out and gently touches her face. Let her slap him for it. Let her rip his arm out of its socket. He doesn't care. But she doesn't do either of those things.
"Come on," she says. "Let's get you over to your bed so you can get some rest."
He stands but puts too much weight on his knee and almost goes down. She holds him, giving him support, the way he once gave her support on the first day she walked. She helps him all the way to the bed, and when he flops onto it, her arm is looped around him in such a way that she's pulled down onto the bed too.
"Sorry."
"Stop apologizing for everything," she tells him. "Save it for your more important screw-ups."
Now they lie side by side on his bed, his aching back stinging even more pressed against the blanket. She could get up, but she doesn't. Instead, she rolls slightly toward him and brushes her fingers across a scrape on his chest, checking to see if it needs a bandage, then determining it doesn't.
"You're quite the freak, Camus Compris. How I got used to that is a mystery to me. I did, though."
"But you still wish I was never made, don't you?"
"But you were, and you're here, and I'm here with you."
Then she adds,
"And I only hate you sometimes."
"And other times?"
She leans toward him, thinks about it for a moment, then kisses him. It's more than a peck, but only slightly more.
"Other times I don't."
Then she rolls onto her back and stays there beside him.
"Don't read too much into this, Cam," she tells him. "I can't be what you want."
"There are lots of things I want," he points out. "Who says I have to have all of them?"
"Because you're Roberta's spoiled little boy, you always get whatever your rewound heart desires."
Cam sits up so he can look at her.
"So unspoil me. Teach me to be patient. Teach me that there are some things worth waiting for."
"And some things you might never have?"
He thinks about his answer, then says, "If that's what you have to teach me, then that's what I'll have to learn. But what I want most is something I think I can have."
"What might that be?"
He takes her hand and holds it.
"This moment, right now, in 1,000 different ways. If I can have that, then the rest won't matter as much."
She sits up and pulls her hand away from his, but only so she can brush it through his hair. She seems to be just looking at the wound on his scalp, but maybe not.
"If that's really what you want most,"
she says gently,
"maybe you can have it. Maybe we both can."
Cam smiles.
"I'd like that very much."
And for the first time since being wound, he feels tears welling in his eyes that he knows are truly his own. Part 6. Fight or Flight. Google search. Feral teenagers. About 12,100 results. 0.12 seconds. Global fault lines. World politics. Political economy. Contemporary. Nihilistic and feral teenagers. The Daily Mail called them. The crazy youths from all walks of life who raced around the streets mindlessly and... The Black Flag Cafe. Copyright. View topic. Feral teenagers attack. 3 posts. 2 authors. Last post, July 7th, 2007. Feral teenagers attack once more. Friday, July 6th, 2007. 10:31 p.m. West Palm Beach, Florida. 2 teenagers were accused of... Feral 007's blog. Random rants about feral teenagers. Teenagers' random rants about feral teenagers. Day-to-day problems of a single parent with teenagers. What to do? Feral teenagers attack strangers in Philadelphia, August 18, 2011. The word wilding refers to gangs of teenagers assaulting strangers for fun and... Feral teenagers beat man to death. News. Wigan. Today, April 4, 2007. 2 feral teenagers who subjected a harmless and deeply vulnerable Wigan man to months of bullying before savagely... Silver Spring. Singular. Coveting thy neighbor's restaurants. June 30, 2010. Bethesda has far fewer packs of feral teenagers, which makes the whole downtown experience over there vastly more pleasant. 52. Lev. Lev is woken by a burst of ice water in his face. At first he thinks he's out in the storm again. A tornado was coming. Did he get hit by a tree? He has to get up, must keep running, running. But he's not in the storm. He's not outside. His focus is blurry, but he can see enough to know he's in some sort of room, looking at a dirty wall. No, not a wall, a ceiling. A water-stained ceiling. And he's lying on a bed. And his hands are tied above his head, tied to the bed frame. His mouth tastes like battery acid. The air smells like mildew, and his head pounds, pounds, pounds. Now he remembers. He was in a van with Miracolina. Hale was pummeling the van. Then they were tranked by...
Awake,
Nelson says. Lev remembers his name now. Nelson. Officer Nelson. Lev had never seen the man's face, but his name was in the news almost as much as Lev's. He doesn't look much like a juvie cop now.
Sorry for the water alarm. I'd have given you a wake-up call, but there's no phone service here.
On a bed next to Lev is Miracolina, still unconscious. Like him, her hands are tied to her bed frame with plastic cable ties. Lev coughs up some water. Nelson sits a few feet away, his legs crossed, holding his trank gun.
You know, I've been staking out the Kavanaugh Mansion for days. Just had a hunch. See, everything pointed to a major safe house in the area, but no one could nail down the location. But the Kavanaugh estate, there's that guard gate made to look abandoned that's not abandoned at all. And all those state-of-the-art surveillance cameras in the trees that border the property. I didn't know the resistance had that kind of money.
Lev says nothing, but Nelson doesn't seem to care. Apparently, he's just happy to have a captive audience.
So, imagine my surprise when I find you and your friend practically gift-wrapped by the side of the road!
Nelson pops the clip from his trank gun, slides out the dart bullets one by one, then reloads it, snapping the clip back in. On the other bed, Miracolina groans, finally beginning to stir out of her deep sleep.
Here's what I think.
Nelson leans closer to Lev.
You are escorting this poor little AWOL girl to the Kavanaugh mansion and into the arms of your scofflaw friends, but on the way you got caught in the storm. Am I right?
Not even close.
Lev croaks.
Oh, well, the particulars don't really matter. The point is, you're here.
Huh? And where is here?
Like I said, says Nelson, waving the gun. The particulars don't matter.
Lev looks over toward Miracolina again. Her eyes are half open, but she's still not entirely conscious.
Let her go,
he says.
She's got nothing to do with this.
Nelson smiles.
How noble of you. Thinking of the girl before yourself. Who says chivalry is dead?
What do you want?
Lev asks, his head aching too much to dance around the point.
I can't get you your job back. And it's not my fault Connor tranked you. So what do you want from me?
Actually, says Nelson, it is your fault. If you weren't being used as a human shield, none of us would be here today.
Lev realizes how true that is. Had he not inadvertently taken Nelson's bullet meant for Connor, then both of them would have been unwound on schedule.
So, shall we play?
Nelson asks. Lev swallows, and his throat feels like it's coated with wood shavings.
What's the game?
Russian roulette! My clip is loaded with 5 trank bullets and 1 nickel-plated lead shell with an explosive tip. I can't recall in what position I put Mr. Bad Bullet. I was too busy talking to you to notice. I will ask you questions, and if I don't like an answer, I shoot.
This game could last for days if I keep going unconscious.
Or it could be over very quickly.
Lev takes a deep breath and tries not to show any more fear than he has to.
Sounds exciting. I'm in.
Well, it's not quite the thrill of clapping, but I'll try to keep you from getting bored.
He takes the safety off the weapon.
Question 1. Is your friend Connor still alive?
Lev suspected he might ask this, so he does his best to lie as honestly as he can.
I've heard the rumors, too,
he says,
but I'm out of that loop. He was taken away, bloody and unconscious, from Happy Jack, and I was arrested. Beyond that, I have no idea.
Nelson smiles at him, then says,
Wrong answer,
and swings the gun toward Miracolina.
No!
Nelson fires without hesitation. Miracolina arches her back as she's hit, releasing a semi-conscious gasp, then falls silent. Lev's heart feels like it's about to explode, until he sees the tiny telltale trank flag sticking out of her shirt. Nelson stands and shakes his head at Lev.
I'd better like your next answer.
Then he leaves, closing the door. 53. Nelson. Nelson decides to give Lev plenty of time to think about it. In the meantime, he sits in an adjoining room of the cottage, researching the leads he already has. Not that many. He has tagged nearly a dozen AWOLs, letting them think they've escaped from him. Some are still on the streets, not far from where he originally captured them. Others are at harvest camps, having been caught by the juvies. One appears to be in Argentina, although he suspects the kid was caught by another parts pirate and unwound on the black market, which means only his tagged part went to South America. There are 2 signals pinging from Arizona at the site of an old, defunct Air Force base. This he finds the most curious. He heard talk of some sort of AWOL sanctuary in the Southwest when he was still with the juvies, but details were sketchy, and he hadn't had high enough security clearance to learn any more about it, or interest at the time to care. In any case, Arizona is too far away for him to jump to any conclusions. Unless, of course, his little clapper boy places Connor there. The trank bullets Nelson loaded in his pistol are the mildest kind, with the shortest half-life. When he returns about 2 hours later, he lingers outside the door, listening. The girl is awake but groggy, and Lev is all about apologizing for getting her involved in this. No talk of Connor or any potential AWOL hideouts. Nelson kicks open the door for effect, then sits calmly in the chair between them, brandishing his pistol, just in case there's any question about his intentions.
"Are we ready?" Nelson says. 5 bullets left. A 20% chance that the next one is lethal."
Lev avoids eye contact with him, struggling to keep his breathing under control. As he already knows the surprise ending of the game, Nelson aims the gun at the girl even before asking the question.
"You think I'm afraid to die? But I'm not,"
the girl says. However, the warble in her voice says otherwise.
"Please,"
Lev begs.
"You don't have to do this."
"I believe I do,"
Nelson cheerfully tells him. He clears his throat.
"Round 2. The question is, where is the Akron AWOL hiding? You have 3 seconds before the buzzer."
"Please don't,"
Lev pleads again.
1.
"Turn it on me. She has nothing to do with this."
2.
"I'm the one with the wrong answers, not her."
3.
"No, wait, I'll tell you.
He cocks the trigger.
"Better make it quick."
Lev takes a deep, shuddering breath.
"Indian Echo Caverns, in Pennsylvania. It's where the AWOLs from the East Coast are hidden. They take them deep into the caverns and keep them there until they turn 17. Connor's helping them run it."
"Hmm," says Nelson, considering it. "It's on an Indian res. I bet stinking slotmongers are always giving sanctuary to AWOLs."
He puts the gun across his lap and leans back in his chair.
"Now I have a dilemma. Of all the AWOLs I've tagged, none of them have gone in that direction. So who should I believe, you or my data?"
"Where were you tagging them?" Lev asks quickly. "If they're west of Pittsburgh, they probably go someplace else if the resistance picks them up. And don't ask me where, because I don't know."
Nelson smiles.
"You know, I'm so glad you didn't blow yourself to smithereens last year, young man, because you've just saved this girl's life. Assuming, of course, that you're telling the truth."
"If I'm lying," says Lev, "you can come back and kill us both."
That makes Nelson laugh.
"If it turns out you're lying, I would have done that anyway, but thank you for giving me permission."
Then he leaves, making no attempt to free them from their bonds. 54. Lev.
"Were you telling the truth?"
Miracolina asks.
"Of course I was,"
Lev says, just in case Nelson is still listening. A few moments later, he hears Nelson's van start and drive off. The fact is, it hadn't mattered what Lev told him. What mattered was Nelson believing it. Lev pulled the location out of his memory. He had been to Indian Echo Caverns with his family many years before. He remembered the guide saying that it used to be a hideout for outlaws. Lev stayed close to his mother, fearing that those outlaws might still be lurking in shadowy crevices. Lev has no idea if AWOLs really are hiding there. He hopes not, now that he's unleashed Nelson on the place.
"So what do we do?"
Miracolina asks.
"If he catches your friend, he won't be back, and we'll starve to death. And if your friend's not there, he'll come back and kill us."
"I thought you weren't afraid of dying."
"I'm not. I just don't want to die a senseless death."
"We won't. Not if I can help it." Then he begins to roll back and forth on his bed. His hands are secured tightly to 2 of the metal bedposts with the cable ties, but his feet are able to build a kind of rocking momentum. He throws his weight left, then right, over and over again, and the bed begins to scrape on the ground beneath him as he does. He tries to flip the bed, but can't build the momentum, and eventually he has to rest.
"It's not working,"
Miracolina says, stating what's more than obvious.
"Then maybe you should start praying. I sure am."
After a few minutes' rest, he tries it again. This time he's able to slide the bed over a little bit more with his rocking, until one of the legs catches on an uneven floorboard. Now, when he rocks the bed, the legs on the other side rise slightly off the ground. He loses his strength, and the pain of the plastic ties digging into his wrists gets to him. He has to stop. But after a few minutes of recovery, he tries again. And again. Each time getting closer to the exact force and the exact torque it will take. Then, finally, releasing a clenched-jawed groan, he hurls all his weight toward the far wall, practically wrenching his arms out of their sockets, and the bed rises, its future dangling like a coin between heads and tails, and then it flips upside down. The metal frame and the mattress land on top of him. Lev's elbows smash painfully on the rotting wooden floor, splinters digging in. With the bed lying on top of him, he has a momentary flashback to the explosion in the townhouse and being pinned beneath the sofa, his brother's face, and Pastor Dan's. He tries to draw strength from the moment, rather than let himself be overwhelmed by grief.
"You did it! That was great!"
he can hear Miracolina saying, although he can't see her.
"Now what?"
"Not sure yet." Lev's hands are still painfully tied to the metal headboard bars. He can see how badly his wrists are bleeding, and there's rust on his hands, too. He thinks about tetanus, and how they always want you to get a tetanus shot when you step on a rusting nail or something. He thinks about how, at his family's beach home, the iron fence had rusted into nothing from exposure to salt air. Rusted into nothing. He looks to where the headboard bars connect to the bed frame. The bar to which his left hand is attached is practically rusted all the way through. Ignoring the pain again, he tugs and he tugs, until finally the pole breaks and his hand comes free.
"What's going on down there?"
Miracolina asks. He reaches up and grabs her hand instead of telling her, and she gasps. The bar that secures his right hand is not in the same weak state as the other, but it is rusty also and rough. He knows he can't break this pole like the other one, so he tries a different tactic. He begins to move his wrist back and forth, scraping the plastic tie against the jagged, rusted metal. Bit by bit, the plastic is worn away, until finally the tie shreds apart and his hand comes free. He wipes the blood from his wrists on the mattress and stands up.
"How did you do it?"
she asks.
"Superpowers,"
he tells her. He looks at Miracolina's bonds, then reaches beneath her mattress to find the same rusted metal. He pulls the bed away from the wall, and standing behind it, kicks at the bars until the ones Miracolina are attached to break free. She pulls her hands away, peeling the plastic loops over her knuckles.
"You okay?"
Lev asks, and she nods.
"Good. Let's get out of here."
But the moment he puts weight on his right ankle, he grimaces and starts to limp.
"What is it?"
Miracolina asks.
"I think I sprained my ankle kicking out the bars,"
Lev tells her. She lets him put his weight on her, and she helps him walk. As they open the front door, it becomes clear where they're being held. It's a cottage in the woods, so isolated they could have screamed at the top of their lungs for days, and no one would have heard them. There's a dirt path leading out to what Lev hopes is a major road. He tries putting weight on his ankle and grimaces again. So she continues to let him put his arm over her shoulder, and he gratefully accepts her assistance. Then, when they're a good distance away from the shack, he says,
"I'm really going to need your help now. You have to help me warn my friend."
She steps away from him, and he almost topples, but manages to keep his balance.
"I'll do no such thing. Your friend is not my problem."
"Please, look at me. I can barely walk. I can't make it there on my own."
"I'll get you to a hospital."
Lev shakes his head.
"When I went to Kavanaugh, I broke the terms of my parole. If I get caught, I'll get locked away for good."
"Don't blame me for that."
"I just saved your life,"
Lev reminds her.
"Don't repay me by destroying mine."
She looks at him almost as hatefully as the day they first met.
"That parts pirate will get to the caverns before we do. What's the point?"
Then she studies him for a moment, as if reading Lev's mind, and says,
"Your friend's not in the caverns, is he?"
"No,"
she sighs.
"Of course not."
55. Miracolina. Miracolina is not a girl given to impulsive behavior. All things must be planned and have sufficient time to settle before being carried out.
Even her escape from the Kavanaugh mansion was not a wild bolt, but the result of careful preparation. Therefore, she is completely unprepared for the madness that overtakes her as she stands in that dirt path with Lev.
"I will contact my parents before I help you get anywhere," she tells him, realizing that by saying this, she's entered